Do wild bears fight in the woods? Property rights. Late nights, worrying about moral justifications is ideal theory. And the transaction costs of traffic management? Today's interview takes up those topics with one of the most important political philosophers of the 21st century, David Schmitz. Four new twedges, plus this month's letters, and more. Straight out of Creedmoor, this is Tidy C.
I thought they'd talk about a system where there were no transaction costs, but it's an imaginary system. There always are transaction costs.
When it is costly to transact, institutions matter, and it is costly to transact.
David Schmitz uses a philosophical method that focuses on what works, much in the vein of David Hume, Adam Smith, and a hero of this podcast, Ronald Coase. Let's listen to a short clip from Ronald Coase from an Econ Talk in 2012.
You've been critical of what you call blackboard economics.
Oh, yes.
What does that mean to you? What do you mean by blackboard economics?
Blackboard economics is an economics which you can put on the blackboard, in which you study an imaginary system. It's not empirically based at all. Is not concerned with what really happens. It's what you imagine could happen and what you imagine didn't happen. Recommends more empirical work. Study what actually happens. Start from there. I don't mean the study that people do with a lot of statistics and so on, not finding out what really happens and getting conclusions based on the investigations, but on bunches of statistics. My view is that you should get down and study what actually happens. Economists don't do that.
And now, the interview with David Schmitz, a scholar who independently arrived at both the method and many of the conclusions of Ronald Coase, but who comes to that work from a very different and important direction. My guest today is David Schmitz, a philosopher and economist who is now at West Virginia University. David, I want to welcome you to The Answer is Transaction Cost. And as I always ask guests to give an introduction to how you came to be someone who studies the particular things that you do. And in particular, today, we're going to talk about some of your contributions in the institution of property. So how did you come to think about philosophy? How did you become interested in economics? And what would turn you towards thinking about property as a subject of academic study?
Hey, Mike. Good to see you. Good to be on the show. Let me go back to the end of my first year in graduate school when I didn't do well in my first year. But one thing I did as I was scrambling to get into some other program and get my student visa renewed and so on, and I ended up in economics. But I meanwhile, along the way, I took a course in the law school taught by Jules Coleman. And Jules Coleman was teaching about property rights. And he said something like, well, if you were trying to decide who has the right of way, who is the proper owner and proper decider of in the case of a dispute where some rancher's cattle has trespassed on the neighboring farmer's land and eaten the farmer's corn, and how would you decide who the proper owner is from an efficiency standpoint? And I said, well, I don't know about efficiency, but like, really, we're supposed to just say what's efficient? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, what's the difference? And I said something. He said, oh, that's interesting. Explain. I said, well, it's something along the lines of there either are gains for trade or there aren't. And if it's efficient for the cows to be eating the corn, then you'd think a deal will be made and the cows will be able to eat the corn. And if it's not efficient to be eating the corn, then a fence will get built, if it's worth building the fence anyway. So Jules said, have you ever heard of Ronald Coase? And I said, no. And he said, have you ever taken an economics course? I said, no. And he said, yeah, see me after class. So after class, Jules said, I've got a friend named Vernon Smith. I'm going to introduce you. because you can't go through life not knowing anything about economics when you've got intuitions like that. I talked to Vernon Smith. I met Vernon Smith and Mark Isaac and a bunch of other people as well, of course. But Vernon said, "Are you looking? I've got an experimental economic science laboratory. Are you looking for work?" And I said, "Well, actually, I am. In fact, I'm about to be deported for lack of visible means of support, and I can't work in the U.S. unless I do something to get another student visa or get the conditions met." So I ended up working in the economic science lab for 2 years and learned a whole different way of doing philosophy. And incidentally, as one of the wonderful things about that particular economics department is while I was working on it, I stopped at the MA. I didn't go on to do the PhD because by the time I finished a year or so, graduate director in philosophy called the Kevin McCabe, who was the graduate director in economics, and said, is this guy okay? I'm just wondering how he's doing. And we didn't intend him to be inherited by anybody. And Kevin said, yeah, he's the best we've got. And so then Jules gathered some more information and then came and said, we want you back in the philosophy program because we just made a mistake when we terminated you. After your first year, we shouldn't have done that, and we want you back. So that's how I ended up doing a PhD in philosophy. But then I took, while I was at Yale, I sat in on courses being taught in the law school on property by Robert Ellickson and Carol Rose, and they were both revelations as well. So in a way, I've been working on that ever since. I've been working on, well, what if the grand question, say, in the theory of property, isn't something like, communism or capitalism? Instead, it's something like, when is it a liability rule that's protecting your property rather than a property rule? When do you have a case for adverse possession? When do you have a case for distinguishing sharply between accidental and intentional trespass? Or when is the answer transaction cost? So all of those things really made me think in a whole different way about philosophy, about political philosophy, about moral theory. I started thinking that these questions of observation, and of course they're questions of thick observation. It's not mere sensation, but it's observing, like Adam Smith did, what's working. Like, so he didn't have a theory of justice and then applied it to the question of whether tariffs were just. What he did is say, what's going on? How are these things working? Why are these things being passed? And what's happening to the price of beer? What's happening to unemployment? What's happening to the nature of communities? What's happening to foreign relations between Portugal and England and France and so on? So he started with observation, like a scientist might, and extracted a theory from observation. And when you extract a theory from observation, what's the conclusion? The conclusion is, well, I might be wrong, but what I've seen suggests that this is the pattern, I'm not seeing causation. Hume pointed that out. What I'm seeing is correlation. But the correlations that I'm seeing, it looks like the way to explain why B keeps following A is that A is causing B. So I started thinking that's actually what Hume was trying to do. Now I'm starting to understand Hume. Now I'm starting to understand Adam Smith, and thinking those people were on the track to doing a kind of philosophy that got derailed in the 1800s, and philosophy by the 1900s had become something altogether different. So that's my background in gradually coming to think the way that I think about it now. And I've been publishing papers, as you know, for like three decades, but basically leading to where I am now in understanding the point of investigating philosophical questions by saying, what do we see when we look around? How are these? So I don't ask, moral theories are theories since the 20th century, since Sidgwick, a moral theory has been what we call a moral theory. It's been a theory about what to do, like how to achieve the greatest good, greatest happiness for the greatest number, say. And that's not what Adam Smith was doing. Adam Smith was theorizing about what works. David Hume was theorizing about what works. That wasn't a theory about what to do. It was about what works. And I'm thinking they weren't even trying to answer the same question, a very different question. So if you go back and say, well, I think Locke was basically a utilitarian or Adam Smith was a utilitarian, that's not exactly wrong, but it is anachronistic because they weren't trying to tell us what to do. They were trying to tell us what to work, what works. Like, so for instance, respecting, like bears know this, any animal capable of locomotion understands there's some reason to defer to the animal that got to the territory first. So you have a new bear, and the new bear shows up on the old bear's territory, and the old bear says, move on, kid. And the new bear says, yeah, you're going to make me. But the thing is, here's what the old bear says next. Says, hey, kid, read my lips. You don't have much to lose. For you, the question is whether to keep moving. For me, the question is whether to give up my identity as having labored on this territory, having spent years protecting this territory and staking out this territory and investing in this territory. And if you just keep moving, that doesn't send much of a signal. But if I let you boot me off, that sends a signal that I am not someone whose claims command respect. So I've got way more to lose than you do. You don't have a reason to fight to the death, but I do. And then the new bear says, I get it, and the new bear moves on. So there's a reason why first possession is not something, it's not something that John Locke made up. The principle of first possession emerged with the emergence of the animal kingdom, basically.
Well, what's interesting about that, about your whole approach, is that Ronald Coase, when he was still a socialist and decided in 1933 to come across the ocean and ask questions of U.S. Corporate CEOs, his goal was just to see how things actually work. There were these theories that markets use price to allocate things, but it looked like these CEOs were giving commands. He was going to go find out by actually finding out how things work. He observed the way contracts work, and he came up with a set of generalizations that were based on what he had observed.
Yeah.
So the story, the account that David Hume gives of property as a convention has almost no moral content. It is that there are some nations that seem to have this norm convention and equilibrium. Ken Binmore claims it's an equilibrium of a repeated game. There's all sorts of stories you can tell about it. But the fact is, it seems to be a pattern that I expect you to respect my property, and you do respect my property because you share that expectation. But it's reciprocal. I will also respect your property. Now, and it's actually fairly hard to break this. The convention's not universal. So the convention might come from all of us acting in this way. But I want to pose a different view of this, because a philosopher comes along and says, well, wait a minute. What you're saying is you can take something from the common stock of resources, and you can just arbitrarily declare, you know, this is mine, which means that it is not yours. So it's my property, which means not only do I have the right to use it, but I have the right to exclude you from using it. Where does that second part come from? So let me read famously from Rousseau's Treatise on Inequality. The first man, who having enclosed a piece of ground, bethought himself of saying, this is mine, and found people simple enough to believe him, was the real founder of civil society. From how many crimes, wars, and murders, from how many horrors and misfortune, might not anyone have saved mankind by pulling up the stakes, filling in the ditch, and crying to his fellows, beware of listening to this impostor. You are undone if you once forget that the fruits of the earth belong to us all, and the earth itself to nobody. So Rousseau thinks about this, and he says, yeah, that's what people do, but it's wrong. In fact, a world that is based on that kind of convention is morally evil. We have to rise up against it and change it. So the convention, it doesn't seem to me, gets to the claim that it's a right I am morally obliged to respect. It's a convention in the sense we're all better off. There are many different equilibria of game. One equilibrium is we all respect property rights. Another one is none of us respect property rights. That one's probably worse. Maybe that's the Hobbesian state of nature. Rousseau says there are some other ones that we can imagine, and we should strive for those. We should not be bound by your archaic story of bears.
Okay. That's a question.
There's supposed to be a question. Why is it that we don't all say, oh, now I see. The scales have fallen from my eyes. Rousseau has solved this problem.
Well, yeah. So Hume says property is a convention, and that's not the only thing that is true about property, but that is a truth about property. So property rights are artifacts in the sense that societies invariably don't take up Rousseau's selection. Societies invariably recognize pathways to legitimizing property claims. And what that means is the propensity to do this, the propensity to create artifacts, is not itself an artifact. So it's built into the human condition that we have a reason to do that and that we have a reason to respect it because there is such a thing as traffic management and there is such a thing as commercial traffic management. And this is all part of that. So if you have someone thinking, taking an opportunity to make land more productive, and someone says, okay, fine, I will take that now. Now that's a little bit like the bear. Now, how does it become human and not just, right, dueling predators or something like that? Well, it becomes human when we become able to talk about it and acknowledge, articulate the signals that we're sending. And then when we can articulate the signals, then we can ask questions about the signals too. We can ask for justifications. But the thing that does the justifying at the end of the day, now I don't know if it's at the end of the day or the beginning of the day, but the point is to say, that's not the point where you bring in a theory. That's the point where you observe. Like, so you say, excuse me, sir, we drive on the right side of the road in this town, not the left. And then the person says something, well, I just got here and I'm from a long way. Okay, so then you say, sir, we drive on the right side of the road, period. And if someone says, well, why not the left? Isn't that arbitrary? So it's arbitrary, but our propensity to have have conventions that we don't regard as arbitrary is not arbitrary. So we say, no, see, the point isn't that the right is better than the left. The right is better than the left here because that's what people are expecting from you. It's that people are expecting it that makes it better. It's that people are expecting it is what makes it peaceful for you to do what they expect, and more or less disruptive or warlike for you not to do what they expect. So the convention is emerging, and it's not being bootstrapped by morality. It's the other way around. The emerging convention is what's bootstrapping morality into the place. You know, that's the point where you start developing the machinery that will enable people at some point to start saying, hey, that's unfair. That's mine. Or there's a reason why I regard it as mine and don't regard it as yours. And nobody else regards it as yours. Everybody regards it as mine because that's the convention out of which you can build communities, or at least this community.
So the property is theft. People are all going to say, yeah, but slavery, patriarchy, those are conventions too, but we know they're wrong. And so we should try to switch them. And so we should get rid of property as theft because it's as bad as slavery or patriarchy. You actually have an interesting argument about the presumption in favor of original appropriation, where it is, you could argue that property is a convention. There's a sort of Lockean story, at least about I've combined my labor with it, but it's not the end of the argument. It's actually the beginning. And the reason that that's important is that then somebody else comes along and does what Rousseau described. Like, you put a fence up.
Yep.
Why don't I just toss the fence down? What do you say that persuades me?
I'm not sure what position I'm saying this from. Like, if, say, I build a fence, you take it, I file suit. Now the question is, what does the judge say? The judge is going to say something, and that judgment is going to become part of the law. So what makes it right for the judge to say one thing rather than another? What makes a difference, the reason it isn't arbitrary, you, the second comer, you say, hey, that there's nothing morally significant about having gotten here first. And I say, well, there's one small thing that is significant, which is that I'm not proposing to take your stuff. You're proposing to take mine. So the fruits of the land that I am turned the land to producing, I don't have to disregard a first comer's claim in order to do that. You would have to disregard a first comer's claim in order to do that. Is that a big difference? Point is, it is a difference. Point is, I have some connection to the land that you don't have. You can't make even as much of a claim as I made without disregarding me, right? So there's a way in which I'm not denying your personhood by saying good luck. You are denying my person by saying move over. I'm taking what you've got.
In effect, this creates a presumptive claim. It's not a knockdown claim. It's not that I can pour a can of orange juice in the ocean and claim to own the ocean. Maybe the extent to which I can claim something, there's a limit, but so there may be some Lockean considerations, but your claim about the presumption in favor of first use is a way of fixing, of remediating Locke's proviso. Because the Lockean proviso seems to be talking about, I've always thought of it just as a sufficient condition. Many people want to argue it's a necessary condition. And unless there's as much and as good, I can't claim property. I would say this is just an arbitrary sufficient condition. There's many others. And the presumption of first use might be one.
We can roll with that. I do think it's fair to suppose that Locke was talking about sufficient conditions. Just the language that he used said, well, this is fine, at least if there's enough and is good for others. So he meant to say the point of the Lockean proviso was to identify what would count as sufficient grounds for a complaint in order to overcome the presumption, which, as you correctly say, it doesn't need to be more than a presumption. What the first comer does is raise the bar on what it takes to justify a subsequent taking. The first comer doesn't have to justify taking it away from somebody. The second comer does.
Well, so that raises a question about the nature of property. Could you say in the abstract what you think is the definition of property? And there are a number of examples that you use in your teaching that I'm quite fond of. The idea of property with, I believe it was Hinman Air, the Hinman Air legal case, was an interesting illustration of the problem of property. So could you say what property is and then how the Hinman Air case illustrates that?
Yeah, this is tricky. Again, there's a lot that falls out of figuring out what works rather than falls out of a theory. But basically, property is, it's been understood since maybe the 1870s as a bundle of sticks. It's more than one thing. To have a property right in something or to something is to be able to sell it, maybe to have a right to collect money for transferring it. It's a right to give it away. It's a right to bequeath it. It's a right to use it as collateral, and so on and so forth. And I say, there is a fundamental, if it's a bundle, not all the sticks are branches, though. There is one that's has to be the trunk, and that's the right to exclude, the right to say no. If you don't have a right to say no, nothing else is sufficient to make your claim a property claim. So that's why I want to say it. So if you say, whose bicycle is this? And I'll say, it's mine. Say, oh, can I borrow it? And if I say yes, and I'm the one who gets to say yes, well, then I'm the owner. But if you have the right to say yes to someone who proposes to borrow it, then I'm not the owner in any regular sense. So the one who has the right to say no is the one that has the, you know, the core, the trunk right. And I would take it that's for whatever it's worth. I don't know if it's worth talking more about that. All you asked for was a definition, but I guess I would say maybe there's something inherently liberal about the whole idea of property because, you know, when you were complaining about slavery and such things, is the thing that makes you not a full person is not having a right to say no. Like if someone else gets to say, yeah, he said no, but I decided that no means yes, that person is running over you and then not treating you as a self-owning person. Okay, so that's kind of characterizing property. And now I want to say there are all kinds of other practical issues that come up that result in conflict, right? And so again, where a philosopher wants to say, well, here's my theory about how conflict, here's my theory about the principles of fair conflict resolution, I want to say, yeah, I got trained that way too, but it still seems backwards to me now. Now it seems like if you actually want to come up with an answer rather than just have dueling intuitions that where the duel cannot be resolved, then you got to start with something other than philosophy. So start with what it takes to keep the peace, start with what it takes to get people to stop fighting. And so you say, are people capable of attaining some kind of truce under conditions that really aren't fair? Yeah, of course, which is why that's not talking about a definition anymore, right? That's talking about how you get off the ground with understanding what it takes to resolve conflict and thereby move in the direction of something that might be the ballpark of justice. So you've got to start with conflict resolution if you're even going to get to the ballpark of justice. So then we'll say there are all kinds of things with, say, the Calabresi Malamud kind of schema that they gave us, which was kind of interesting. And not only them, but you could say there are times when you can't really protect property with property rules, right? So your neighbor knocks on your door and says, I'm really sorry, I didn't realize where your kid had parked his bike on the sidewalk. And as I was backing out of the garage, I ran over it. I'm sorry. What does it cost? I'll buy the kid another bike. And then you say, well, maybe now I've got a difficult decision because now I've got to say, this sounds like, yeah, we've been neighbors for a long time. And honestly, that doesn't sound like your fault. And then you say, well, how about if I'm going to buy the kid a $100 bike, but that was only worth $50 anyway. So how about if we split the cost or something like that? And will that make us good neighbors?
And so the distinction you're making, because it is an important one, a property enforcement would be I have somehow infringed on your property because I broke the bike. A liability rule would be that I have to make you whole by restoring the value of the bike. You are saying in actual conflict resolution here, we've been neighbors a long time. My idiot son had no business laying his bike down in your driveway. And yeah, you drove over it, but that, let's just split it. And yeah. So that's kind of a bargaining solution that has a longer run. It's more like liability rather than pure property. It's not even clear what the trespass you would.
Well, it's a way of showing respect for property when maybe the horse is out of the barn and it's too late for the property rule. And so you could say, this is why it matters whether we're talking about accidental or intentional trespass. Like if the person says, look, we've been neighbors for a long time and I want us to remain on good terms. But your kid said something, used a slur against my kid. So I'm telling you what I'm just letting you know what I'm going to do. I'm going to run over your kid's bike whenever I see it. And I'll just pay you to buy another bike because I don't want you to be mad at me. But I do want your kid to live in fear of what I'm going to do next. So I want that. So, but I'll pay you for any damages. And then that's the point where you get to say, no, you don't get to decide that it's okay to run over my kid's bike. That's not your call. It's not your property. You don't get to do that. A property rule protects me against you in that sense. But if it was an accident, that's different.
Yeah. Oh, that.
Where sometimes, great. We have a lot of friends who think that something like a Fifth Amendment, a takings clause, eminent domain, it's an abomination. It's part of any property system I've ever heard of, because here's the thing you have to say about that Humean convention. It's presupposed that if it's going to be a Humean convention, we can live with it. We can afford it. So, and that gets us to, the Hinman case that it would be nice to talk about. But
that's really interesting. So what you're saying is it's a rebuttable presumption, but it can be rebutted in the case that it would be very inconvenient. And so I will put up the link. And Hinman versus Pacific Air, 1937, it's interesting that you raised the bundle, because if I live in Texas, I could sell or rent off the mineral rights, which means I own the land, I own the air above it, but the mineral rights, the right to take oil or uranium or whatever else that's below the surface, I can sell that off and it's separable. So I have a bundle of sticks. I find that one stick that you want, which is the mineral rights, and I hand it to you and you give me money. We sign a contract and we both agree that we're better off. Now, maybe I regret it later, but we have a contract. Hinman Air wasn't really like that. Hinman Air was taking one of the bundle of sticks, and it was against the will of the owner.
Yep. Okay, so let me give me a minute, Mike. Here's a transition between eminent domain and the idea of a navigation easement. So with eminent domain, you say our community is premised on respect for personhood. We built a community by making it affordable for people to live close to each other. We've dialed down the threat that people pose to each other. We've made it possible for people to trust each other. All kinds of ways, things that we've done to make it possible for people to trust each other. And property is a big part of that. Like maybe it's one of the biggest parts of that is to say, hey, there is such a thing as minding your own business. That's not internally inconsistent. There is such a thing as minding your own business. If that's your basement, yeah, you get to do what you want, except when you don't. Right, there are things you don't get to do, even if it is your basement. But at some point you say, okay, we had this understanding that you could put a fence around your property, you could put up a no trespassing sign, and that was not to be balanced. That wasn't to be weighed in a utilitarian calculus. You had a right to say no. You said no. End of story. And now you say, okay, I know we said that. We thought we meant it. We did mean it in some sense, but the facts weren't what we thought they were. The facts are, we thought you could do that, but the fact is you doing that on your property is turning out to pose an external cost on other people. It's turning out to be poisoning their water supply, or it's turning out to cut off their access to the port. It's doing something that we didn't anticipate. And because it's doing something that we didn't anticipate, that the community can't afford to countenance, we have to say, I am really sorry, but we are going to take back some of what we, for very good reason, said was yours. And we said you had the right to say no. We thought we could afford to respect that, but we can't. Okay, now easements are like that. They're in effect like a mini eminent domain. And we can get at the idea of easement by talking about that Hinman versus Pacific Air Transport case, because do you have a right to say no trespassing? Well, sure you do. You put up a fence, you say no trespassing. No means no, period, end of story. And then you have a rancher who files suit and says, yeah, they're trespassing. The judge says, what do you mean? Well, they're flying over my land. At what height? 10,000 feet. And the judge says, yeah, is that true? And Pacific Air Transport says, that's not trespassing, though. Like, it's not land.
Well, as the name suggests, we're an air transport company. And so, yes, yeah, we're flying over his land.
And so the rancher says, well, you know, we've known for 2,000 years, we've understood for 2,000 years that to own the land, he who owns the land owns it to the heavens. And there's like a cylinder going up, or maybe it's a cone going up, something that's not really super clear, doesn't have to be super clear. But anyway, you own your land all the way up and maybe all the way down. That turns out not to be quite right either. Okay, so here's what the judge says. The judge says it's all transaction costs, right?
There's a smiling puppy dog there. The answer is transaction costs.
Yeah, Murphy knew I was going to say that. So the judge says, okay, clearly I know what the verdict has to be. The verdict has to be it's not trespassing. But I also know that that can't be the case because, like, I can't abolish property. I can't be the judge who ruled that property is theft. I have to say, no trespassing means no trespassing. You really can't trespass. But then the judge says, well, really, but property rights just don't extend that high. It's like, you know, people were wearing skins and kilts and things and togas back when that rule was interpreted that way. There weren't any airplanes back then, so we can't do that. So we have to say property rights don't go that high. And then, like within a couple of weeks, the interpreters and people like, you know, writing case books and things, they said, well, nah, here's what actually happened. The ruling was that that isn't trespassing, but the reason it isn't trespassing is that there have always been navigation easements. This isn't some radical departure. This is just the way we've always done things. We've always said that you can't acquire property in such a way as to maroon some owner on an island where he can't get out. And we've known that if you cut off access to the beach, then you have to open up a space between your fence and the neighbor's fence so as to allow public access to the beach. We've known that you can't put a wall across a stream that is a navigational water, that is what ships use to get their merchandise to the city center. You can't do that. There are easements. And so this is just a navigation easement. We've always recognized that there were such things, and now we've just recognized that we have them at 10,000 feet as well.
And the interesting thing about it was that to the extent that property can be oversimplistically a right to use and a right to exclude, all they were saying was that he didn't have the right to exclude. If he wanted to fly airplanes over his house, he was welcome to. He still had that right. It's just that other people did also. And probably they didn't have the right to park a giant balloon over his land permanently.
No, and they
block out the sun.
Right. And they didn't have a right to empty the latrine on his land as they were flying over. So that would have been trespassing. That would have been, the rancher would have won the suit in that case. But the reason it's all transaction costs is the judge has this alternative, right? It's to say, okay, it turns out that like when I was a kid, it took 6 weeks for a piece of mail to get from New York to LA. Now it's going to take 6 hours. Do I want to be the person who said, no, we can't have that? No, I don't want to do that. But if I say every landowner on the ground has a right to seek rents and to threaten to veto this passage, I can't be the person who ruled that way. I can't turn everybody on the ground into a troll at a drawbridge, threatening for no particular reason to shut down commerce.
And that is a problem with Rousseau's argument about the...
It certainly is.
That it's the anti-commons. So yeah. The problem with the anti-commons is if I have to get everyone's permission, I can never do anything. Yeah. And we want me and you and you and you all to be able to do things.
Yeah.
Not to the extent that we violate property rights, but an easement means I get to use it for a particular purpose for a brief amount of time. It is interesting that if you read the case closely, there are two claims, really. One is nuisance and one is trespass. The nuisance claim, some of the planes were flying pretty low and they were loud. This was 1937, so they were flying pretty low. And the judge agreed to the nuisance action. It was upsetting the cows. You guys should fly higher.
Yep.
But you can fly. Because the alternative would be you have to get permission of everybody between Chicago and Los Angeles in order to deliver the mail. That's prohibitively expensive in terms of transactions costs. And there's no justification for it because we've had these easements for a very long time. So that brings me to the last question. And I'm embarrassingly just a fanboy about this example of yours, because the example of me having to go and get the permission from every landowner makes me think of the example of Desert Town, where we have a couple of alternatives about how we might decide how to do things. So can you say, how did you come up with the example of Desert Town? Because I actually want to make a movie. I have to admit, I would like to get with my good friend John Papala and the guy who did the Keynes Hayek rap videos with Russ Roberts, and we should do a 5-minute Old West style video for Desert Town. So please, if you would, share the origins and the story of Desert Town.
Thank you. As far as I know, Mike, you're the one who came up with the name Desert Town. Maybe you remember it differently, but I see where the name came from. One of my favorite articles was a takeoff from what had become a pretty typical position. A Rawlsian position, but not only Rawls, but if it's a Rawlsian position, it's pretty mainstream. But Rawls had said, look, I've got two principles of justice, of principles about how to slice the pie. And what I've always said is, yeah, well, that's what happened in the 20th century. We started thinking that justice was about how to slice the pie. We forgot that justice is about how to treat bakers, and that's a terrible thing to have turned that, you know, the dynamics of the human condition, to turn that into a photograph where you see, hey, some people have a red light, some people have a green light. That's really unfair. Everybody should have a green light at the same time. So I started coming up with ways of picturing what people were saying and just saying, You would never get that from reality. You, like a judge, could not possibly take that seriously. You could only say that if you're in the grip of a theory. So I started talking about all of the ways in which the paper was called How to Deserve, and it got a lot of attention. Basically, talking about ways in which the way we live recognizes all kinds of ways, indispensably recognizes all kinds of ways in which respect involves respecting what we bring to the table. It isn't to say, the important thing about you is you as a consumer of a slice of a pie, you as a stomach into which we shovel a slice of pie. The important thing is, you brought the pie to the table. And you, with it, you brought a right to say no. So how do we respect that? Because that's what justice is actually going to be about. So then your Desert Town was that comes from a preface that I wrote to the book version of the article, where the preface was like, you know, a cop pulls me over on the side of the road and says, sir, you new in town? And I said, yeah, just got here. And the cop says, so do you know what you did wrong? And I say, no, I didn't go through a stoplight. I didn't go through a stop sign. And the cars on the cross street were stopped. So I took myself to have the right of way and I kept going. And the cop says, sir, in this town, we distribute according to desert. And so when now it's the Rousseauian move, turns out it's like it's Officer Rousseau. It says when motorists meet at an intersection, they stop to compare destinations so as to ascertain which of them has the worthiest claim to the right of way. And so if you attend our track meets, you'll see the same thing. We don't award gold medals for running the fastest. We award them for giving the greatest effort. Because anyway, that's why the other cars honked when you drove through, because you didn't stop to compare destinations and to compare relative destinations. And so the cop looks and I say, I'm sorry, officer, you got to be joking. But I don't get the joke. And the officer says, sir, justice is not a joke. I was going to let you off with a warning until you said that. So that's I think where Desert Town comes from. That wasn't I didn't come up with a name for it. I think you came up with the name.
Well, the pun, of course, it looks like Desert Town, but because it's spelled the same, and so that is what I enjoy so much about it. So I have used that example to illustrate problems of regulation, of antitrust, and one of the arguments it can be marshaled to try to make is for rural utilitarianism generally. So we have a rule, and the rule we might pick in this case is the unfair rule you already mentioned, a stoplight. And stoplights really make me mad. I'm often late. Clearly, my errand is of great moral significance. I know these other people, they're just poking along, but they happen to have a green light. It's not fair. If I had a forum where I could argue for the moral significance of my errand, then that would be more just. The problem is that the maximum time I have to wait with a stoplight is 2 minutes. The minimum, if we all get out and argue, is 7 and maybe 20 minutes. And so we might unanimously pick an unfair, but just in the sense that it's arbitrary, rule over a rule that requires us constantly to make only justice rather than the costs of living our lives, the primary factor. And so that's why I think it's such an interesting general example.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. Thank you. I mean, I'm honored just to be on the show at all, but I'm honored to have this conversation in particular. I think you know my view about this, that we do well not to equate arbitrary with unfair. That in fact, if you say, no, I'm the referee of this game, I will make sure that the best team wins. And you say, no, the ideal is for the best team to win, but the referee's job has nothing to do with making sure that the best team wins. Right? So and so you might say, well, what makes a lottery fair? And you might say, well, that what makes a lottery fair is that the winner is chosen arbitrarily. If the winner is not chosen arbitrarily, then you say that's where the unfairness came in, is the lack of arbitrariness. So so Rawls, I think, really wants to crush the distinction between, say, what he calls the natural lottery. That's just what happened. And he wants to, and Nozick understands this, Nozick pointed this out, like that's not a situation in which somebody decided that some people will be born with a cleft palate. Some people will be born destined to be Wilt Chamberlain. It's like And nobody's born destined to be Wilt Chamberlain. The point is, some people have the genetic potential to be Wilt Chamberlain. But yet, that's not fair, but it's not unfair if it's arbitrary. If it's chosen, if somebody is, if we say we want to engineer a lower class, that starts to sound heinous. If it just happens, then there's a question about how to respond to it. But what we're responding to isn't injustice, isn't unfairness. It's just a tragedy that can be alleviated, or suffering that can be alleviated. So I want to say that about the difference between being arbitrary and being unfair.
Well, we could obviously talk about this for a long time. I do recommend, I'll put up several of David Schmitz's writing on the show notes. Let me ask one final, more open-ended question. What progress have we made in legal understanding of property, in intellectual property, in the last 20 years? And this is something that I think you've thought about. I don't know if you've written much about it, but in the last 20 years, there's an awful lot of things, music, art of various kinds, writings, that because they're in the public domain on the internet, can be used to train artificial intelligence, that can be used to train computers that can generate images that are indistinguishable. They're in the style of the author or the singer. To what extent is your view about first use? Because I'm not preventing you from using it. And what I'm saying is, I'm going to use something with your likeness, your voice, and I'm going to produce a new Beatles album of what they might do today. I'm going to produce new art that Picasso might have made. Is there some ownership that persists beyond the creation of intellectual property? And what's going to happen with the new artificial intelligence, the ability to internalize this and then create new things? Is property a concept that's going to kind of disappear and wither away, in this realm at least?
Yeah. So the mark of a good philosopher, Mike, is that their go-to answer either is it's transaction costs or else I don't know. So I really don't know. I've heard many arguments about this. I kind of believe them all. They contradict each other, so that's a problem for me. So I really see things being pulled both ways. I don't see theory answering this. I see convention emerging to answer this. I do think there are principles that are relevant. So enforcement cost is relevant. Incentivizing research and development and creativity is maybe the most relevant thing. So, you know, if an artist is producing novel works, that really matters. I mean, that should be celebrated, honored, rewarded. Now, if somebody says, okay, but here's the thing, what you would want ideally is for an idea to emerge, to be perceived as cutting edge, to be perceived as a path of progress, and you would want people running with it. So you don't want to turn the original artist into a troll at the drawbridge, but you also do want the original artist to want to be the original artist and to feel rewarded for having been the original artist. So it's like, you know, with traffic management, property rights aren't like green lights. Property rights are like red lights. And you say, so why would you want to have red lights? Well, because then you know your turn is coming up in 2 minutes, and you can live with that. And other people know your turn is coming up in 2 minutes. And a fundamental thing about this is, if your turn is coming, you don't have to sort people out into upper class and lower class destinations. Right, you can actually have a liberal egalitarian society if it's governed by something like traffic lights. If you're governing by the the relative importance of destinations, that's going to be a tyranny. Okay, now with intellectual property, I don't know where to go with that. But like I said, another issue is enforcement costs. So if you say, well, yeah, the Beatles, that's pretty unique stuff, ought to be respected, should never be forgotten, should be superseded, for God's sake, superseded. But don't forget it. Always honor that originality. But on the other hand, suppose some technology comes out of China for making, is it CDs? Is it digital music? What is it? Where in effect, you took, you know, a 10-foot electrified barbed wire, razor wired fence that people couldn't get over, and you lowered that to 1 inch. And then you said, hey, people, don't step over that line. You got to respect this. And they say, well, yeah, when it used to be illegal for me to spend $5 remaking an $8 record, that was the law was some disincentive. But when it cost 2 cents to make a pirate copy of an $8 record, I'm going to make a million 2 cent records, and I'm going to get rich, and I'm going to get out of town before the law can catch me. So you can't, if you respect property, you've got to respect the lines where no trespassing signs can actually be effective. And so if there's no place for you to draw a line technologically and protect property there, then you got to realize when it's a lost cause, and you pretending that you can and have drawn the line there is just words. So, you know, that doesn't get me to an answer to your question. And I don't have an answer up my sleeve. I just don't know. But I do think we're on a series of step frontiers here where what was an answer a generation ago will have been rendered moot by the technology that's just around the corner. So I do see the point of intellectual property. I do see the limits of it, and I just don't know what else to say.
Well, you advanced some principles that we might at least wrestle with, and that's pretty helpful. So I want to thank my guest today, David Schmitz, for having been on The Answer Is Transactions Cost. David, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Murphy. It's been great to be on the show.
Whoa, that sound means it's time for the Twedges, this week's economics jokes. First, I should note that David Schmitz signing off for my dog Murphy was partly because Murphy kept barking. I cut the barking part out, but David was kind enough to acknowledge that Murphy had been an important part of our conversation, so I thought I should explain. The first Twedge. Pierre Perdone goes up to the counter and orders a Tazo green tea with toffee nut syrup, 2 espresso shots, and pumpkin spice mixed in. The barista warns him, that's going to taste terrible. Pah! Scoffs Perdone. Proper tea is theft. Second, Jeremy Bentham goes up to the counter at a coffee house holding a $50 bill. What's the cheapest drink, you ask? He asks. Well, that would be our cheap coffee roast, I guess, the drip, for only $1.99, says the barista. Good, says Bentham, and hands her the $50. I'll buy those for the next 25 people who show up. Third, what do you get when you cross a joke with a rhetorical question? Fourth, the dean asks the head of the physics department to see him. Why are you using so many resources, all these labs and experiments and stuff? This is getting expensive. Why can't you be more like mathematicians? They only need pencils, erasers, paper, and a trash bin. Or better yet, philosophers. All they need is pens and paper. We got some letters. One letter writer notes that people are buying gold bars and coins at Costco using the spending on their credit card to get cash back or airline miles and then reselling the gold bars. Except it turns out that reselling is expensive. Well, transaction costs, and the bid-ask difference more than eats up the expected profit. So people are actually holding overpriced gold bars that they thought they were going to be able to make money from. Interesting article about this in the Wall Street Journal. I'll put up a link to that in the show notes. Second, from Ryan Berkmans, a past guest, he writes a letter that there's a huge change. Airlines operating in the U.S. will soon have to automatically refund you when your flight is canceled or even delayed, 3 hours domestic or 6 hours international. Or if your bag is lost, the refunds have to be paid within 7 days. The new rule of the Biden Department of Transportation starts in 6 months. Well, it's interesting to think about what is likely to happen as a result of that. I thank Ryan for the letter. His point is that it's likely to have quite a few unintended consequences in terms of price and how long in advance a flight might be canceled, because if they can't be sure that it's going to be full or if there's a chance of bad weather, they're better off just not flying at all. Now it's time for Book of the Month. There's two books that I want to suggest this month. First, Johnson, Lush, and Schmitz, David Schmitz, who was our guest this month, in their book, Commercial Society, A Primer on Ethics and Economics, was published by Roman and Littlefield. It's a terrific consideration of a lot of the practical problems and ethics in commerce. So not abstract, but at the same time, not really business ethics. It's a serious treatment of the morality of commerce. And then a graphic novel that was just published by the Cato Institute that I'm a big fan of. It was written by Brian Kaplan and Addie Brenzai, called Build Baby Build. Well, the next episode will be released on Tuesday, May 28th, the last Tuesday of the month. We'll have a new interview, have another book in a month, plus we'll have four more hilarious twedges and more next month on Tidy Sea.